I think it's in the hard times sort of that trigger this sort of need to reflect. If you're a seeker, you want to understand yourself. And for me, I realized that I wanted to understand myself through a difficult moment. And that just opened up this sort of curiosity and endless curiosity around, you know, everything from my childhood to what values I stand for.
So we finally get to do this.
Yeah, we do.
Me and the Honorable Mr. Amir Farha.
Good to be here, man.
Thanks, my man. I think anyone who hasn't been living under a rock in the tech space knows Amir Farha, co-founder at Kotu, and many, many exciting things you've done with your life, which I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about. And for me, a very close and dear friend most of the time.
Most of the time, yeah. It's been more than a decade we've known each other, bro.
That's true. That's true. I think probably before we started Bayzat?
Around the same time.
Around the same time.
Actually, I met Talal before I met you.
Yeah. So...
yeah, so it's
You're
nice.
Actually the original Bayzat guy. Just spelt incorrectly.
Well, yeah, I could... whatever you want. Whatever you want. Sure, that's the story. Especially your brother. He'll have a different take on that, but yeah.
So, I think from a personal perspective... you were one of the first investors in our company, Bayzat. I'd say definitely along the way over the past 8-9 years building the company, one of the most supportive people through the journey. I think you've always had a founder first mentality. Nice. And then on a personal level, when I was going through some tough periods, you gave me some advice that put me on a good path. So I wasn't joking when I said, you know, close friend as well.
It's mutual, man.
We were joking before the episode started on, for some reason I had in my mind that you like had a chicken farm or something, and that was your first entrepreneurial experience, and you immediately corrected me and said it was a web development.
Yeah, yeah. Web design, web development agency.
Yeah.
That was way back in 2008.
Okay.
No chicken farm.
Chicken farm would have been a great story.
Farmer, man. I wish. I don't wish, but I mean, like, it's not in my DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, my first thing was I met a guy who's great at web development, and I had some access to potential customers. We partnered up to start this sort of agency where I would funnel in leads. He would execute the work, and then that started my understanding of service businesses. And then through that, I set up a consulting company called Tandem Partners with one of my old friends, Rabia Brer, who's still running the business, doing a great job. And then services businesses don't scale, but I ended up setting up Beko a long time ago. That's how we got connected. Well, before Beko, me and your brother got connected.
Yeah.
And Beko, we got connected.
Yeah. And
you were a GE at the time.
I was a GE, correct. Yeah. Correct. So you had done the entrepreneur game from the inside, but then you decided to become an investor. Why did you feel that that was more suitable for you?
Man, my life. So I did computer science as an undergrad. Didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated. Ended up continuing to do a master's in the UK in a place called Bath. Then I at my master's did my thesis with a big real estate company, publicly listed real estate company called CLS Holdings in London.
Yeah,
founded by this phenomenal Swedish entrepreneur, and he took capital off his balance sheet to invest in public and private investments across the technology sector in the UK and Sweden. And so when I did my thesis there, I learned what venture was. And then they offered me an internship, which turned into a full-time role. Did that for about 2 years, 2.5 years. And, you know, what inspired me in the role was just meeting these amazing people trying to change the world through tech. And when I came back to the region, I was like, I want to do something in venture. And ultimately, there was nothing.
Yeah.
There was like, you know, 5 tech companies in the whole Middle East. Mm. So I set up this web design agency and then joined the what was the first seed fund in the region called the Arab Business Angel Network, where Waleed Hanna was there. Khaled Talhouni was sort of, I took over from him. He went to Accelerator Technology Holdings in Jordan. And so that was the sort of inception of, you know, the, I wouldn't say the ecosystem, because Fadi Ghandour was investing much earlier than us. But essentially, we tried to start seed funding, and then that didn't work out because of the global financial crisis, and we were very early. And so I ended up setting up this advisory firm with my friend in 2009, and then 2011, early 12, set it up Becca with my cousin. So I've always wanted to be in venture.
Mm.
It's just, it was my first job. And then, you know, even though I set up a couple of service companies, the goal has always been to invest in startups. It was just, it's just a space that excites me a lot.
Yeah.
Because it combines, you know, difficult problems with people, and you know, you're against the odds. So I like sort of taking risks. And so, yeah.
And
I don't know if that answers you. I know I ramble a little bit, so I'll
it's okay. I'm sure there'll be a lot of different moments of rambling today. We'll
yeah, just keep me in check.
No, all good. The idea of investing in companies, building a venture ecosystem before there was a venture ecosystem. I mean, I remember when we were first fundraising, you guys were one of like 3.
Yeah.
And I think even like in the seed round, you guys hadn't, Beko hadn't started yet, even in the initial phase in like 2013 or
2012 we started.
Okay.
We did deal by deal investing. We didn't have a fund up.
Yeah.
You guys came in when we had the fund, which was 2014.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, the labeling wasn't really there. Like, pre-seed didn't exist.
Yeah.
Seed, you know, was, you know, arguably, you know, 250K rounds or something really tiny.
Yeah.
So it's a very different world today.
But I guess
when
you're starting something ahead of, to a certain extent, you guys were let's call it a group of you were ahead of the time in the context of saying that we want to start venture investing when it didn't really exist in the region. And so how do you, I guess two things. Number one is, how do you have the conviction that this is something that will eventually pan out? And then the second is, how do you manage your own psychology or your own emotions to say that I have the conviction that I'm going to continue to do this. I just have to be patient, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, look, I think the patience consciously, you know, it is a patient space, patient industry. I think when you're, at my age, I was 29 when I set up Beko. So you're kind of young and foolish.
Mm.
You want to change the world. You just go for it. I was lucky. I mean, Danny who was my partner at Beko, set up bait.com with Rabia Ataya back in the day.
Mm.
So they were one of the few, the 5 tech companies I was talking about that went up and raised venture funds from Tiger
a
long time ago, right? Mm. They tried in the ecosystem, there was nothing. So they went and they managed to do that. And so he had a perspective. I mean, he came from building that company, sold his shares, and then, you know, we started this together. And I came from the perspective of investing. So in my experience, even as a analyst in that team in London, you know, you could see the change happening much faster. And, you know, the Middle East is a few years behind most mature ecosystems, especially like innovative countries like Stockholm or Sweden and London and UK. So, you know, it's obvious it's coming. Now it's capital is a catalyst. The challenge we had was just raising capital. Mm-hmm. And remember when we did deal by deal investing, it took us like 9 months to pull capital together. You know, we invested in Property Finder, we signed the term sheet, and then on closing, it took us from signing to closing maybe like 6 to 9 months.
To get the actual money.
Yeah. Well, not the contract, it's just to structure everything, get the money and all these things. Like it was very much not done before.
Yeah.
So it was a long slug. And then raising a fund, I mean, we set ourselves up as a evergreen fund.
Okay.
And if you look at history, we were inspired by this book I read called The Startup Game by Bill Draper, who's the father of Tim Draper.
Okay.
He was the founder of a firm called Sutter Hill Ventures. Sutter Hill Ventures, I think, have done so many successful companies, including Snowflake and others. They set up themselves in the 70s as an evergreen structure in an ecosystem that was just being established, because you don't have control over like exit horizons and the returns compound. So being permanent capital is actually the best way to invest in early ecosystems. So we set ourselves up as a holding company and raised funds from high net worths, no families really, just mainly high net worth individuals that have high risk appetite. And you know, we managed to pivot our own way from a holding company to an actual fund structure. We adjusted the first entity from a holdco to a fund, and then we raised fund two because we realized there's no endowments or pension funds in the region that take that kind of 25-year outlook. So the challenges were much more difficult to catalyze. So you need capital to catalyze it, and we were trying our best alongside others like Fadi and Waleed and a few others.
Yeah. And what are the conversations like when you're trying to fundraise, and it's something you've never, it's not like you come from a venture background and you're trying to raise a fund to invest. You basically have to convince the people that one, the venture space is one worth spending money and time in, and then two, to bet on you guys who don't have venture experience.
Yeah, I give a lot of credit to Danny.
Yeah,
I think if you think about it, he was one of the early ones and successful ones at Bait, and so that credibility was big. And I knew how to run, sort of how to look at startups and, you know, write the memos, research the companies, think about the business models, make at least the investment decisions a bit more influential on that level. And the combination was really powerful because being family also, it's very rare. And that was the kind of the credibility he brought and the execution skills. And together we were able to show people that we can do the job and execute. And we were lucky. We got Property Finder, which I think was a massive reason why we managed to raise our first fund. Then we got Kareem in that fund, another reason that we raised the second fund. Second fund, we got Katopi and at the time Swivel, that helped them raise fund three. I left it after fund two. So there's like, that's the game. We were able to be lucky by backing the right founders at the right time. And because I think, there's an expression in venture, maybe we don't have to get into it now, but this whole idea that the lemons ripen early. So the ones that don't work, you see them quite quickly, but the ones that do take a bit longer. But in Property Finder's case, in Kareem's case, you know, after investing, they were just out executing on so many levels. So it was undeniable that there's value that's being created. So when you go to investors, you don't have to present this philosophical thing. Although the question still remains on exits, even today, even 10 years later.
Yeah.
But you're seeing a lot more exits happening now.
And
don't forget to keep me in check when I ramble.
No, all good. It's part of the experience today. The lemons ripening
early.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. So I told you about the book, The Startup Game.
Yeah.
So the author, Bill Draper, I emailed him.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, we're in the Middle East. We're starting this holdco structure inspired by Sutter Hill Ventures and stuff. And I was like, we're a holdco. How do we think about portfolio construction? Because it's finite capital. We have to keep raising, but then we have to make sure our portfolio is constructed in the right way. And he told me about this because, you know, as in venture, the lemons ripen early. So you know which ones are not good. You kind of have to support them, but kind of focus your attention and capital towards the ones that do. And so you learn, it's constant iteration and you see it, we're governed by the power law. A lot of companies will fail. That's the nature of the business. And hopefully the ones that succeed are, extraordinary outcomes for both founders and the investors. And you generate alpha that way.
Yeah. What do you see as common themes between the lemons that ripen early?
Common themes? I mean, there are many reasons why. Co-founder dynamics, very common to have issues there. I think timing, also coming in the market too early. Execution, you know, just not executing fast enough, not making fast enough progress. I think, you know, thinking about go-to-market in a very focused way, being focused on the right things on the product side, not trying to do too much with, you know, too soon.
Yeah, the focus thing is super, especially when you're early and you see like the world of opportunity.
Yeah, man.
And you want to go after it all. That most startups die of what? Indigestion is the saying.
Yeah, it's always easiest to engage on anything. It's just super hard to be disciplined.
Yeah,
I still do it, even as an investor, like doing this for so long that I still have struggled to be focused on what I do.
Yeah.
So it's a natural human, challenge to do that.
And as you built Beko with your co-founder, obviously now when you look on the outside in, very successful firm, great companies that you invested in, I'm sure it wasn't always rosy on the inside. So as you were thinking about, as you went through your fundraising, as you went through the building, the business, like looking back at it, what are some of the moments that stick out where you're like, God damn, that was a really tough time in the company's history?
Yeah. There were many moments.
Yeah, yeah.
Both, you know, challenges and opportunities. My mindset is to kind of maybe focus more on the problems or the challenges that we overcame.
Yeah.
I think the first one was just raising the first fund.
Mm.
It didn't take us that long, to be honest. But it was like definitely a new experience that we had to go through. I think, I don't know how, I think there were some choices we made. Like I remember investing in Careem was a big debate amongst me and my partners. Mm. The IC had, I led that discussion and met Mudassir and, you know, you could tell early on that they had some crazy momentum going. When Uber came in, their sort of traction just went through the roof. While people were saying that Uber's gonna, you know,
take them out,
yeah. Not even on, like take them out, but they didn't. They, in fact, you know, accelerated the growth. And so, you know, you're debating with partners about like whether to invest, and there was a lot of contention there, on whether it's the right opportunity. And three times we got a no, or I got a no, and then the fourth time we managed to get a yes. So that was a pretty difficult one. And obviously, you know, we were lucky because it returned the fund for us.
The interesting thing is I asked you about the pivotal moments building the company and what you what came to mind, and like 60% of the stories you talked about are the stories of the pivotal moments that some of the key companies you invested in we're going through as a reflection of your journey building Beko. Sorry, just hear me out. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that it seems like you almost see the reflection of building your own company at the time as one part and parcel of the journey of the entrepreneurs that you invested in, versus I see a lot of funds that invest and they're like, cool, and I deployed capital. Now it's the founder and the entrepreneurs who are going to go on that journey. And we as a fund, our success is determined by how these founders do, but we have our own journey as a fund, as a VC. But one thing that I've always felt is you feel your journey as a VC is intertwined with the journey of the founder themselves. And you're invested not only from a dollar perspective, but from a mind share, emotional perspective. I don't know if that's a fair observation or not.
You know, we were all invested, let's be clear. Yeah, like, you know, Danny was a super high energy and very much vested into a lot of the companies, including Careem and Property Finder and others. I feel like when you're sort of, I wouldn't say championing, but when you're kind of trying to, when you fully really believe in someone or something, or you know, this sort of mission, it kind of takes over, and you have to have that energy and drive. Otherwise, just won't get there. Like, you know, raising our second fund, 2 years of like, you know, blood, sweat, and tears went into that. I think if we just didn't have the energy for it and the belief, we just wouldn't have come. I think that shows up in our relationships with founders. I think for me specifically, yes, I'm, to my credit and my sort of flaws, I get emotional sometimes in these sort of relationships, and whether it's fundraising or supporting the founder's journey, trying to make them succeed the best I can, or when there are some challenges, I'm very candid with my approach. I don't, you know, hide from my thoughts, and, you know, challenge each other. That's mutual. It's not just one-sided. And to this day, I still learn. I mean, some of the founders I've backed with Code2, they teach me all the time how to be a better partner. And they call me out when I'm a bit too emotional. And I call them out when they need to be a bit more firm and focus on the right things. So it's like this sort of, you are loosely tied in with each other's lives for a long period of time.
Mm.
Sometimes, and hopefully for till the end of time, because it's such a unique experience. That these are like lifelong relationships that are forged.
Yeah. And how do you manage the balance of being emotionally invested with the founder, the company, but also managing the stakeholder aspect of being an investor? And because sometimes those things can go, can be at odds.
It's a good question. I think first of all, I have an amazing team around me who keep me in check. They know me. They've seen me in all my colors and shapes and sizes and stuff. They're able to like...
Many shapes, many colors, many sizes.
Exactly. I mean, you know me long enough to know me. But they're able to, you know, add value to that, to those choices. They're able to bring perspective that I don't necessarily have, and, you know, manage my sort of reactive behaviors. Everyone has those things. And then the other one is on sort of understanding myself and my values. I think that's been a big pivotal moment for me. I think when you do enough reflection and you spend time thinking about that, I think you can have a great lens to make decisions. And then, you know, when you're triggered, you're generally something is wrong from a values perspective. And it can allow you to figure that out faster than normal. So yeah, I use that as a sort of a proxy. I try my best to be aware of it. I mean, some days you get, you lose awareness in certain situations, but that's been a big sort of guiding light for me as I make, you know, life choices and work choices.
So having a lens through which you look at, or understanding yourself and understanding your values, that doesn't, you know, many of us will go in life where we don't actually understand any of those things until it's too late. And so to understand them is inherently quite a process. You have to be intentional. You have to invest to get there. And so talk about the journey of understanding yourself and understanding your values.
Look, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. It's a subject that I've been spending probably the past 7-8 years thinking about. I think it's in the hard times sort of that trigger this sort of need to reflect. If you're a seeker, you want to understand yourself. And for me, I realized that I wanted to understand myself through a difficult moment. And that just opened up this sort of curiosity and endless curiosity around, you know, everything from my childhood to what values I stand for. And I, you know, have a coach. First, I did something called the Hoffman process, which
you convinced me to. Give me a nudge.
I didn't convince you. I'm not like forcing you that.
You put a gun to my head and made me go. Talk about the Hoffman process, because some of the audience, like in general, what is the process about? Like,
I mean, everyone has their own experience there. It's definitely a very personal one.
Yeah.
But essentially, you go through your life, your childhood, and you identify your, you know, negative patterns and patterns that you've picked up from typically your parents, your upbringing, and you try and you know, undo them, kind of disconnect from them through various tools. But in that process, you really discover a lot about yourself.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And it opens up a whole level of exploration for yourself. Mm-hmm. So that was a big moment for me. And then, you know, I had a coach who I still see today, who was a big driver in me thinking about my values through, she taught me meditation and I went through that journey. But on the value side, I think it's like, you know, for the most part, I realize some companies, they put aspirational things, like they'll be, okay, you know, let's talk about win-win, or, you know, integrity is a value and respect is a value, or adventure, or, you know, curiosity. And like, I feel like, you know, on a surface level, they make sense, right? But like, everyone defines it differently. Like your definition of integrity is probably slightly different to mine.
Yeah.
And same thing with curiosity, and respect can show up in so many different ways. And you only understand your values when you're faced with hardship. It doesn't show up in the good times. It's really in the tough times where you have tough moments where you determine how these things show up. How does integrity show up? How does respect show up? And so what the exercise, or what I went through, is just trying to understand the behaviors in those difficult times. How will it show up for me? What are the drivers that, or the value drivers, or the values that I care deeply about? And you tend to find that they're only a handful. You care about fun and curiosity, but maybe it's, you know, integrity and respect that are your biggest drivers, and then everything falls around that. So I think that took me a long time to discover. But in the process, I started once I identified them, I started seeing everything differently, like my work differently, my relationships differently. Mm. And when life choices would come my way, I would then have that lens to use as a tool. And it made me make, you know, profound, difficult life choices uphold them as much as I can. But also values evolve over time as you go through more and more life experiences. Things will, you know, enter that, you know, and drive you in a different direction, or in, you know, a different way.
Yeah.
So it's like a constant reflection of that. But yeah, it was, I don't know if that answers your question on the value side.
Yeah, I guess also, I remember before I did the Hoffman process, like I had this fear that on some level that I'm going to come out and I'm going to be a different person, and, you know, I might have to live a different life. Will I still get along with the same people? Will I still enjoy the same things? And so that, I found that when there's talk about this like step function transformative change, there's also this element of like fear that sits behind it around what path could this lead me to?
The unknown is always fearful, man.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it's liberating when you let it guide you. Yeah. And then you find your way for sure to a better place most of the time if you're not driven by the fear and let it overcome you. I know this is, you know, sometimes this becomes a very philosophical thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I'm now like, I feel like stuck in life, or not even the word stuck, but I feel like there's something, use the word seeker. If you're a seeker, what does that mean?
I mean, you kind of seek to learn.
Yeah.
You know, you seek to understand. It's just this constant questioning of life and yourself, and internal mainly.
Yeah, yeah. And so, if I'm that kind of person, which I am, and I feel stuck, or I feel like I'm longing for something more, for the lack of a better phrase, where do you recommend somebody like that starts? Because I know you've done a lot of work on yourself. Oh. And
I don't know, man. I feel like it's a very personal thing again. Like meditation helped me.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a great place to start.
Mm.
Getting a coach, nothing beats getting a coach, therapist, whatever, who can be a sort of listening to your issues and then help maybe give you some guidance around tools that would help you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, therapy was like the first step I took that really set me on the path of all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And then you alluded to the fact that your values forced you to make some, or enabled you to make some tough decisions, some tough life choices, or
No, just when you have, when you're, everyone's goes through life and they're probably facing, you know, certain critical decisions yeah. In their journey, it allows you to, you know, deal with those moments with much more alignment around who, you know, what you stand for and how you want to show up.
Yeah, yeah. And then you ended up, I guess, leaving, or I guess you ended up starting Co2 Ventures. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't think it was a combination of many things. It was a combination of this sort of values experience, or just uncovering, like, from the Hoffman to getting a coach, meditation, and just learning about myself. And then the combination of, like, this, the rate of growth we've experienced as an ecosystem. I mean, when Danny and I were investing with Fadi and Waleed, of course, $20 million in all of MENA VC, 2012. Last year, we were at $2.5 billion, right? And I think around 2020, it was maybe closer to $1.5 billion, maybe something like that, or maybe $1 billion. But, you know, you're talking about, like,
extreme
growth.
Yeah.
And so what that means is there are just pockets of capital missing where you need to really invest in the capital stack of the ecosystem to make sure companies can go through the whole journey. And then the second one is, like, knowing who I am. So knowing myself as an investor, and I feel like what I uncovered is I just love being at the earliest moments in the journey of a startup, like as early as ideation, as early as just talking and throwing ideas around, giving confidence to the founder, just challenging them to think differently, all the way through to post-product launch. So, like, let's call that seed, even though today it has different meanings. Where, you know, go-to-market is still a question, hiring key people in the company is difficult, fundraising is still a huge challenge. And that's my game. That's what I realized after years of investing at Beko, that I tend to love that space. It's naturally where I like to spend my time. And to build a firm that does that is very different to how we were building Beko. It's just different strategy, different structure. And if I really want to sort of fulfill my own personal aspirations, I have to build this type of firm, which is alongside me learning my values, this combination that just made for the right time to try it out.
What did you learn about yourself in that process of transition, let's call it?
Well, I learned how to not be attached to my identity with things. Try my best to do that. And when you're starting a company, it's very hard because you care about it so much.
Yeah, yeah. Especially for any entrepreneur, any founder, the company becomes their identity. They become the company becomes them. And so what do you mean by detach yourself from that? Like, tangibly, what does that mean?
Like, I don't identify myself as a mere... But that's somehow how I meant. So I look at myself as, like, the person who stands for these values, who's, you know, a 41-year-old Lebanese guy living in Dubai. I don't know. I mean, like the character more than what I do and who it reflects who I am. You know what I mean?
So you figured out.
Well, it's a personal thing. I don't. You know, externally people can look at me differently.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
really,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So detaching from your identity. What else did you learn?
Living my values, making tough choices through these values. Because, I mean, you know, you do the exercise, but then you have to make the choices. Yeah. So it's like actually executing it. And, you know, I thought about courage. I think courage was a big one. Like, that was a huge amount of courage it took. And I reflect on my mom, actually. She's a big driver for me and my courage. But, like, courage to, like, step up and raise a fund solo. And, you know, you have fears that come.
Like, 100%.
I realized that I wanted, you know, early on I was trying to get partners with me, and I realized like that doesn't necessarily, that's not coming from the right place. And, you know, it took me a bit of time to figure that out. And I just have to kind of manifest what I want to create, and then hopefully the right people will come along the way. And it's happening. That's exactly what's happening. Yeah. It's just, you got to be patient. What else did I learn? I learned that, you know, there are certain people that showed up for me that I truly like value, in so many ways, many of them founders, many of them friends.
Yeah.
And family comes first. I mean, my family were there for me throughout, and obviously it was COVID, right? I left during COVID, so that's a whole journey.
Yeah.
And then I got married 6 months ago to an amazing wife, like who also, like, I think if I hadn't left, I probably wouldn't have met her or found the time. So there's so many learnings or experiences that came out of it that, you know, it's never ending. I mean, this process is never ending. But
And so now you're fund one.
Yeah.
Deploying capital. How do you feel?
Most of the time I feel great. Some moments, you know, when you get caught up in where the market is and like all the sort of negative news generally, not so great. Yeah. But I don't let that catch up too much. And my team are really just, I'm lucky to have them because they like lift me up when I'm low. But I feel excited. I mean, look, what's exciting is like, there's so many VCs that exist. Some of them, and everyone has their own strategy. Like before, it used to be only a handful of us. Now they're like, you know, tens now. And there's no right way to do venture. Everyone has their own way. You know, we subscribe to our own style and strategy, which is great because founders have choice now. They can pick who they want to partner with more than before. I think Saudi is just like going through a rate of change that I don't think we'll ever see in our lifetime in the next 10 years. That I'm just like so blown away by it, and the quality of founders there, it's just, you know, surprising in an amazing way.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's much more interest coming inbound now, what's happening in the Middle East, outside of obviously the geopolitical stuff, which, you know, you can't get away from.
Yeah. You use a lot of us team. What have you learned over the years about working with the right people?
It comes with values again. So I think about that, like trying to hire through that lens. You know, having a level of ownership. You know, giving a level of ownership. I can. Like other people, you know, everyone has their own stuff. I have like a bit of OCD sometimes, but you know, which shows up. But like my team, I try and give them as much freedom to you know, do things and you know, work how they want to work. But generally, all of them exhibit high ownership levels. I think that VC is a collective; it's not like an individual thing. Like you know. Even how you add value to companies and how you work together as a unit, there's so much value you can create if you're a collective. And everyone brings different perspective. I think that's hugely valuable. If you have the right team and you allow them to have, you know, their own thoughts and put them into the equation, it can really create value. Yeah.
And, you know, you said something that VC is a collective. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like... you know, this idea of attribution, you know, people talk about it in the world of venture, like who led what deals and how, you know, and it just becomes this sort of framework to create politics, to create like agenda and egos in the equation, right? I mean, if it's a collective, people just feel ownership collectively around every deal, you know, and they want to support every opportunity the same way.
Yeah.
And it just creates a lot more value, you know. But that's just what I subscribe to. I mean, you know, there are many firms that are built differently.
I heard you say a couple of things in our conversation today. I heard you say, you know, especially have the energy to be passionate when you have the conviction, like having the energy goes a long way. I really like this idea of looking at your life through the lens of values. I think that's something I'm going to really walk away with, as well as this whole idea of detaching yourself from your identity and then having the courage to do the hard things. I think it's easier said than done, especially I think your life as a friend, when I look at it, is continuously defined by big moments of courage. And so I've had a lot of fun talking to you today.
Can I add something though?
Yeah.
This detaching yourself from your identity, it's like, detaching your identity from what you do, kind of thing.
Okay.
Like you're not what
you
do.
You aren't your company. Yeah. You aren't your. Yeah. No. So but thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
All right, anytime, bro. Good to catch up. Really appreciate it.